Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Monday. I'm Charlie Sykes. We're going to have a debate about whether or not the president is really unwell, right? There's no way to do that because the president just cannot help himself. I wrote in my newsletter this morning, I really didn't want to write about this because I'm not a doctor. I don't want to be doing Twitter diagnoses. And I kind of remember all of the bullshit about Hillary Clinton's health and everything. And, you know, talk radio hosts doing their faux medical stuff, the whole she's really ill and keeping it a secret. You remember that whole thing? And of course, it's so obvious the president is fundamentally unwell in different ways. But then he has to do the weird thing at West Point, giving, by the way, want to talk about a low energy speech. And so two things. President seems to have some difficulty, you know, drinking water. Big deal, right? No, it's not a big deal. President, very tentative, walking down this very sort of shallow, slopey ramp. And it's like, okay, whatever. It's, you know, about a 10-minute news cycle until the president of the United States himself has to tweet out about it. So we're going to have to talk about it. So we got a lot to talk about this morning, and we're joined by, for a first timer, very rare that we have first timers on the podcast, Lucy Caldwell, former campaign manager for Joe Walsh. Still trailing clouds of glory from that, aren't you, Lucy?
Yes, it was all glory all the time. Thanks for having me, Charlie. Happy Monday.
We appreciate it. Well, you're a dog person. We had briefly talked about that. We needed to get some dog people on because there's always a little bit of cultural tension when we do a podcast with somebody that I know in the back of my mind is a cat person. Like, I think Tom Nichols is great, but I'm thinking the guy's a cat person. So it's like, you know, so you're a dog person. What, you have two dogs?
I am a dog person. And Tom is one of the first people I think of when I think of cat people, but I'm a dog person. And really, to show what a dog person I am, I've been quarantining in Southern Colorado. And today, some extended family arrives and they are bringing with them five dogs. And so when you put them all together, as of this evening, we will have seven dogs in our home, including a 9-month-old yellow lab puppy. So we are very, very committed card-carrying dog people around here.
There will be some issues there. That's like a dog park in your house. So dogs, you know, my philosophy is that dogs have to work it out among themselves. That there's a hierarchy. And it might be intense in the beginning, but then they figure stuff out, right? So these dogs met each other before?
They have met each other. They've spent many a holiday together. And the five who are en route spend a lot of time together all the time. They're, you know, they live between two houses, but see each other all the time. But the probably the funniest character in all of this is our 7-year-old, 17-pound cockapoo who thinks of himself as the alpha in our home and rules very harshly over our very sweet, docile 3-year-old doodle. But as soon as these other players come into the mix, he will be reduced to his part of the pecking order. So we just respect what the dogs have going on. That's our strategy, and we don't get involved.
it's hard sometimes. And we have this very elderly dog of indeterminate origin. He's about 15 years old. His name is Pete, and he thinks he's the alpha, and he is actually the alpha. The other dogs do not mess with him. They don't you know, take things away from him. And occasionally, you know, when the other dogs are playing or romping around, Pete will just bark at them, just like, kids, stop it, get off my lawn. So it is interesting. We have the full range. Anyway, so because we need to like prioritize where we are at in this moment in history, I got to ask you about Ted Cruz. All right.
Yeah.
So Ron Perlman, would you describe him as a B-level actor? I mean, okay. So he was Hellboy,
that's,
right?
Yeah, that's so flattering.
He's tweeting out about Jim Jordan or something like that, or about Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan, whatever. It's not that important. Ted Cruz, who is a United States senator from the state of Texas, former candidate for president. And because I like to humiliate myself, I have a picture up on my wall. I've said this before. I'm going to take it down. Anyway, Ted Cruz tweets out this morning, "Listen, Hellboy," writing to Ron Perlman, "listen, Hellboy, you talk good game when you've got Hollywood makeup and stuntmen, but I'll bet $10,000 to the non-political charity of your choice that you couldn't last 5 minutes in the wrestling ring with Jim Jordan without getting pinned. You up for it? Or does your publicist say, too risky? So, Lucy, you know, is Ted well? I mean, since I'm going to work up to the is Trump well? What? Ted Cruz, Harvard-educated lawyer, one of the great legal minds of our time, right? Constitutional scholar, and he's tweeting to Hellboy. I need your insight on this.
You know, there's no one who's better at cosplay than Ted Cruz. At any moment, he's playing a different character. It was last month, I think, that he got into that kind of really ugly Twitter scrap for no reason, to where he then started talking about women's panties and just, I mean, it was, I can't even remember. I've blocked it off. It was so appalling. But yeah, I think that Ted Cruz is definitely not well. And it's certainly a shame. But when you think about Ted Cruz, he's been playing characters all his life. You know, he's a guy who was educated at Princeton and Harvard Law, who then, like a lot of our friends on the now Republican right, kind of decided to affect a different shtick. So he became this Texan who says y'all and was really Western. And then when his attempts to kind of stay vaguely close to principles fell out of favor, that was no problem for Ted Cruz, because he wants to be whatever the masses want him to be. And so I think he's unwell, but I think he's probably been unwell for quite a long time. And we're just seeing the illness more in full view now that we're in this crazy era.
Okay, so if he's playing a character, what character is he playing, though? In his mind, what character is he? Who is he? What is he dressed up as today?
I think he is the heir to his Zodiac killer, you know, heritage. He probably, when he gets out of bed in the morning and kind of ambles into his bathroom, he probably looks in the mirror, and where the rest of us might see a reflection of a man who seems to be in a perpetual midlife crisis, he sees a guy with a cape and hopefully not spandex, but some kind of cape outfit, I imagine he sees in the reflection, and he just thinks he's doing battle against the radical left. And that's why he would, I mean, Jim Jordan, why would that be the guy that you think, you know, whose corner I want to make sure everyone knows I'm in? Ohio favorite wrestling coach Jim Jordan. And I'm gonna really, I mean, Jim Jordan probably isn't thrilled by those tweets either. It's like, why are you bringing up that whole thing again?
Okay, see, this is the interesting thing about this, because, okay, so it's one thing that you're going to bat for Jim Jordan, but you have to go into the wrestling thing, because the wrestling thing is the nice way of putting it, problematic for Jim Jordan, considering that there's all this scandal about sex abuse. If you're Jim Jordan, you really like don't want to be talking about Jim Jordan wrestling guy, you know, like when we were, you know, naked and sweaty in the gym. I mean, what? You just don't want to go there. So you're Ted Cruz. Okay, so we're making light of the unwellness thing, and I'm sorry to do that, but I just have to take a deep breath. So you watched the stuff on Saturday from West Point?
I did. I would say that, you know, the trouble going down a ramp and drinking water really is nothing compared to the other disturbing behavior he exhibits all the time.
Well, that's right. And I linked to the other stories. I mean, you know, Jim Swift for The Bulwark wrote a piece about the president is mentally unwell. There have been a lot of stories about the president being unwell. It just was so bizarre. And frankly, as I said, I would have ignored it. But then he has to tweet out because he cannot help himself. So this is what he tweets out. The ramp that I descended after my West Point commencement speech was very long and steep. It wasn't. Had no handrail. And most importantly, was very slippery. The last thing I was going to do is, quote unquote, fall for the fake news to have fun with. Final 10 feet, I ran down to level ground momentum.
He's a legend in his own mind.
Trump's claim that the rampant and very slippery was inconsistent with the weather, which on Saturday was sunny and clear sky. The grass plain on which the commencement took place was dry, and there is videotape. He didn't run anywhere. So this would normally be no big deal, except the president, I don't know whether it's the Lincoln Project or who it is, they're living in his head. So he sees they're making fun of him on Twitter and he has to respond. So now it's a thing.
Yeah, I've been really interested in how he's how much he's given us all in his willingness to respond to this kind of stuff, but especially to be so impacted by the, you know, for lack of a better term, never Trump wing of the opposition to him. I did wonder last week when he told Harris Faulkner that Abe Lincoln hadn't been all that great. Like in his weird twisted head, is that because he's now thinking about the Lincoln Project and associates Lincoln now with something bad, and he's going to go on Fox News and tell a black journalist that old Abe didn't do much for black Americans? I mean, it's really unbelievable. But it takes me back to the thing that James Carville said a month or so ago when he said that, you know, the left should be looking at what never Trump Republicans are doing to try to take the guy down, because the idea that you just kind of operate politely is not going to work with this guy.
You know, that is an interesting point. And I keep thinking about why the number it is, by the way, you know, I want to talk to you about the Walsh campaign, because you've been through, you know, all of these ups and downs where for a moment it looked like never Trump was the most irrelevant of irrelevant folks, that we were essentially the Japanese soldiers hiding out in the caves after, you know, 10 years after the war was over type thing. And now suddenly people are going, no, you guys are relevant, doing good stuff. Republican voters against Trump, Lincoln Project, and Carville making the point, you guys need to do what they are doing. And do you have any theories about what the secret sauce is? I mean, I have a theory about the Democrats and their problems, which is sort of a little bit more cosmic, which is that anytime the Democrats, and people are going to get mad at me about this, they're all sitting around the room, and members of all of the various interest groups and caucuses are sitting around the room, and you have to check all the boxes and you can't offend anyone in the room. So it must be this elaborate process with lots of tripwires, and make sure you check certain boxes and every box is checked. Whereas George Conway and those guys, they don't give a shit. They're just throwing this stuff up against the wall.
Yeah, and I think that one of the biggest problems the Democrats have right now is that they just take the joke too far every time. So, you know, when it feels like they're bringing people into the fold, whether they're disaffected Republicans who voted for Trump in 16 or couldn't have stood to vote for Trump, you know, people who are politically moderate. And I think that the country still is a fundamentally conservative, so-called conservative country. So they need a sector of those Republicans and independents to come into the fray. And it seems like every time that they're given some gift, usually from Trump or congressional Republicans, that makes people think, oh my God, I don't want to be a part of that. I'm going to go be with these guys over here, these guys being the Democrats. The Democrats take it too far. So whether it's having tolerance for ridiculous talking points like defund the police, or, you know, these kind of really absurd political stunts like all marching down and posing in kente cloths over a police brutality and criminal justice reform bill, they can't give it up. And so I think that you can say that Project Lincoln Project is so-called not giving a shit, but I also think it's more a function of, let's focus on what's core here, which is we have a fundamentally indecent person in the White House. We have Republicans in power who are behaving indecently too. And let's just try to ask people to speak out and say, the American values that I have in decency, transparency, generally not effing up everything in the country and abroad, supersedes how I feel about what happens on Social Security reform next year, right? But the Democrats can't seem to get that through their heads. So every time that they get more folks in the fold, they think this is a great time to push everyone toward being warmer on single payer, or this is a great time to let activists go out and say we should defund the police. And instead of saying that's a ridiculous thing to say, here are the things we should actually do, to spend time explaining away what we should think that means. So I think that they just can't help themselves. And so hopefully they can get that together.
Well, yeah, that is true. I guess the good news is that Joe Biden has been very clear. We're not going to defund the police. James Clyburn was on, I think, CNN over the weekend saying absolutely not. We're not going to defund the police. But, you know, there is some real stresses and strains because you do have the activists out there who are saying we're not only going to defund the police, we're going to abolish the police. Right. And those are not winning slogans here finding ways to rationalize what's going on. And, with some of the looting. And again, this is kind of fringe stuff. But this comes back to that we all live in these alternative reality silos. And, that if you, walked into a room where there were, conservative, Republican, folks, and you say, well, what's going on this weekend? They would bring up Antifa and Seattle. I mean, this just dominates the discussion. And I do think that sometimes the folks, our friends on the left, don't understand how when they're engaging in performative wokeness to one another, how that looks to the rest of the country. And I know that Garry Kasparov, who is the former world chess champion, has this great piece, Gary piece in the New York Daily News, who says, this is kind of this violence, this stuff is like a lifeline to the president. He writes, Trump's white knights arrived in the form of rioters, looters, and the mostly Democratic mayors and governors who are unable or unwilling to control them. The Trump administration is eager to blame Antifa for the violence to create a boogeyman worthy of fear-mongering and an authoritarian response. His Democrats won't protect you message gains strength when a swath of Seattle is occupied by protesters. Whether the rioters are disgruntled leftists, criminal gangs, opportunistic anarchists, or anyone else, they are just what Trump was hoping for. And people may not want to hear that, but Kasparov is right, isn't he?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I've heard I've actually heard some pretty strong cases made in recent weeks in defense of rioting, certainly not in defense of looting. But it's true that when you look at who was actually doing most of the violent acts, a lot of it were, like white YouTube celebrities, right? I mean, I have a big connection to the state of Arizona, and there were these YouTube personalities, storming Scottsdale Fashion Square, a mall that anyone who's ever been a tourist in Arizona has been to. In that way, yes, that's sort of like sabotage of what the Black Lives Movement is looking to put forward, and we can't lay that blame on them. But I think in general, I think when you think about who are the sectors that it's an election year that we want to see come into the fray, and we think about some of those really important audiences, suburban women, mothers who have children, right? A complete disregard for keeping the peace, or an idea that everything is fine when a big swath of a city has been taken over and is a police-free zone. That's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous idea. And so I think that for moderates who want to see Trumpism eradicated and see Trump and Senate Republicans voted out of office, it feels a lot like when the left, whom we're trying to work with here, when they don't come out and disavow that kind of behavior, it feels like we're cleaning up their messes once again. And that's really a tough struggle to be in.
Well, and again, we've been having this discussion now for more than a year, pointing out that, look, 2018, you look at 2018, and the Democrats won in these swing seats with the suburban voters. They didn't win with candidates like AOC. They won with candidates like Abigail Spanberger and others, people who actually understood all this. So let me just go back a little bit, because I want to talk to you about, for our listeners to understand what's been happening on the right. I don't want to put any words in your mouth. Okay. So my sense is you're a pretty full spectrum, hardcore conservative. How would you describe yourself?
I guess that's the case. But the truth is that conservatism and republicanism in its previous iterations really was a thing that I was associated with because it's where my particular political philosophy found its warmest bed. I came up in really functionally libertarian politics through think tank world. I lobbied in almost 40 states early on in my career on issues like public sector union reform, which now we're suddenly all excited mm-hmm. about and Democrats love, apparently, which is so great. You know,
when it involves the police, the police right. unions.
Right. And we could spend all day talking about why that won't work from a single subject legislative perspective, because the way that we've avoided having public sector union reform is that Republicans have been carving out police unions for years. And then we follow a very familiar pattern where, you know, a teacher's union sues and it's all very, very coordinated. And then whatever reform has just been passed by that state that is no doubt a good thing, you know, paycheck protection, transparency and collective bargaining, you know, is all undone. So that will happen over and over again. But now I guess we have different allegiances. But republicanism and conservatism was really just where the things I believe in, really, I mean, I grew up in the West. I grew up, you know, in a place that was very much kind of like, don't look over my fence, I won't look over yours. And that faith that people in general know how to make the best decisions for themselves and their families, in their communities, and that government largesse is a problem, that those ideas and that belief set just found its warmest bed with Republicans. And I will say that definitely the last 4 years have caused me to rethink some of my underlying views. And I think a lot of people are not as frank about that as they can be. I think someone who has been very frank about that has been, you know, someone like Max Boot, right? Thinking about, were we always on this crash collision course? And we just right. didn't look up and look ahead. But at the moment, my views haven't changed so much. But now I'm just a sort of politically homeless person. And I have comforted myself by just kind of committing to this idea that I will never be sucked in by a political tribe ever again in my life. So I break from other people in that.
Well, that's the good part about it, right? Is you're politically homeless, but also you're politically independent and therefore liberated, so you can make these choices. Okay, so you were pretty much solidly never Trump. Talking about, so Joe Walsh comes along. Now, Joe Walsh was hardcore conservative. I mean, I was a talk show host. He was, I would say, to the right of me, and was much more Trump friendly up until 2017, and then. We used to call him Woke Joe. Woke Joe yeah. broke really hard against Trump. He saw through it. He understood what a betrayal this was. It cost him his career on radio, which is, of course, now a very familiar story. There's no business model. So he really took a huge leap. And then he jumped in and said, if nobody else is going to do it, I'm going to run. And I'm going to run to Trump's right. And so you sign up with him. Now, this is just so, you know, I want to make it clear. You know, I like Woke Joe. We had him on the podcast a lot. I didn't go along with the presidential campaign. I thought this is a great guy to be on the team with. Don't necessarily think he could be president. You know, a lot of things in his background, but I don't want to litigate that. So you are part of the Joe Walsh campaign. And Joe did some interesting things. You went out into the, you know, Trump world, into the conservative grassroots. And these were his people. He knows how they think. He knows how to talk to them. And the experiences, I think, were interesting. So let me just, this may seem like a cosmic question, but what did you learn about the Republican grassroots from this experience? What did you learn? What is your takeaway from what happened in that campaign and what's happening among Republicans who have decided they're drinking the Trumpian Kool-Aid?
Well, I think that the operative word is Kool-Aid, because what I really saw was among the Republican grassroots community. And when I say grassroots, I really mean people who go to rallies, are part of the activist community. They have just completely suspended giving a damn about all the things they used to give a damn about. So whether that's the national debt or even just the broken promises of Trump himself over the wall that they're never going to get, or, you know, a lighter touch on tax policy, whatever the case may be. And so I think that to see those folks, it was shocking to hear what they said, because they would say things like, and I mean, I'm talking about doing things like, Joe would go to Trump rallies and we'd stand in the rally line and he'd walk up and down. And it was fascinating, because there were some people who would say to Joe, they would recognize him, right? I mean, he's a person who, you know, brought up and mentored Charlie Sykes, right? He was hugely visible in, Charlie Kirk. He was hugely visible in, I know Joe didn't bring you up. Yes, very different person, probably not a dog person, as I would have to guess. But, you know, he was pretty visible to these folks.
Charlie Kirk raises lizards. I'm just convinced of that.
Well, he's moved to Arizona, so he may be doing that. That's very possible. But there was a group of people who would say, Joe, I love you, man. I love what you're doing. But, you know, why have you left the team? Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I don't like everything he does. But the Democrats are socialists, and I don't understand why you're doing this. And then you had another sector of this group who would talk about, I mean, really almost was like a parody of the callousness that the left has been projecting onto the right for years. Like, well, my 401k is doing great. And that we would hear about people's, you know, flourishing 401ks all the time. And then another sector were people who just felt like Joe was a complete traitor, and, you know, would scream at him and talk about how he'd been sucked in by the left. And so the thing that I came away with was, one, this is a group of hardcore supporters who will shift a narrative any way they can to make it fit with their idea of what makes sense. But the second thing that I think was more interesting, and as you know, folks I work with, whether it's Joe Walsh or others, as we think about how to make an impact on typical like Republican voters and conservative independents this fall, it was clear to us that persuadable voters who may have voted for Trump, may not have, don't like the guy, whatever, they're actually not really seeing this kind of footage. And they're not watching Trump rallies. They're not really interacting with the hardcore Trump base. You know, they're like, maybe they're reading Instapundit or Ann Althaus, maybe. Whatever the case may be, they're getting a very, very different view, a very manicured view of the Trump White House than the rest of us are getting. And I think that goes to your point about what was the news of the weekend, right? Is it Antifa for someone? And so showing those people images of Joe, and Joe is a rabble rouser, but he also is a person, I've never met someone more able to keep his cool. So showing those persuadable folks images of Joe talking calmly to a person screaming at him and sort of saying these insane things that no normal person would say in defense of Donald Trump, or watching Joe be, I mean, almost to the point of being physically attacked, but basically run out of the Iowa caucuses because he said, I want you to have a president who doesn't lie to you. I'm a pro-life, pro-Second Amendment conservative guy. And, you know, this guy cannot be our president. And I'm coming to you as a person with conservative values. Those images, in that interaction, he's not impacting those people that he's interacting with. I mean, maybe he is, but
okay, so he said that, and he was basically run out of the Iowa caucus. So he's basically saying, I agree with you on all of these principles, but you shouldn't have a president who lies. So here's the question about the lying. That made them very angry, right?
Super angry.
The president was a liar?
Super angry.
Super angry. Is it because, A, they genuinely do not know because they live in a world where they don't know that the president lies all the time? Or B, do they live in a world in which, yeah, they know that the president lies and they just don't care because it's, you know, Team Red versus Team Blue and then the alternative is socialism? So don't know or don't care, or a combination there?
I think it could be either, but both conditions fall into this broader condition of caring more about being on the red team than anything else. And an example of this is, you know, we spent a lot of time in Iowa. Joe Walsh is from Illinois. It was easy to get him there. He went to school there. He's a Midwesterner. There was a lot of reason to think that he would connect with Iowans. And we were having great success in Iowa in early fall, and the Ukraine stuff began to happen and the impeachment stuff began to unfold. And we thought, oh my God, this is our moment, right? This is it. And at the same time in Iowa, we had made a lot of inroads with the Iowa cattlemen, and they were actually talking about endorsing Joe, which was kind of insane that was on the table. But it's no secret that Trump has not been very good to Iowa. Iowa farmers have been super disproportionately affected by tariffs. The ethanol industry has really been decimated by this president. And so it seemed like a place where Joe was going to get a good hearing. And so we're busy, you know, coordinating kind of a big meeting with the cattlemen and all this stuff, months and months of talking to them. And then impeachment began, and Joe came out in favor of impeachment. And at that moment, it was like we were dead to these people, like dead to the cattlemen, even though they don't like him. Because it was like...
This is fascinating.
Yeah. And the upshot basically was like, look, we don't like him, but he's on our team, he being Trump. And you're just really, really stepping outside of being a team player. This is beyond. Like, it's one thing to criticize him, but supporting his removal is just a bridge too far for us. And that was it. Which is, I don't understand how to square that.
No. This is an important insight, because that there's some of the phenomenon that the harder people push against Trump, the harder his support becomes, the firmer. So what you're describing are people who are open to an alternative to Trump, but impeachment actually made them circle the wagons, to abuse mixed metaphors here, which is also the danger that in any other circumstance, the more endangered Trump becomes, the more the harder his folks are going to, you know, demand loyalty.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there's a sector of audience where, when we look at the map, and the map of the map of the Electoral College kind of freaks me out, to be frank. I'm probably a little less bullish than other folks are on a kind of Biden runaway, in part because I think all these numbers that are being thrown around are mostly national polls. But when you look at the map and you think, okay, we need to turn states like Michigan and Arizona and Wisconsin, and, you know, the list goes on a bit longer, to be blue states, part of that is not just getting folks who might be normal Republican voters to cross the aisle. It's also on figuring out what is the right balance to strike that will cause some people who could never bear to go out and vote for Biden to just stay home. And so it's that line of how much do you show them of how outrageous this guy is, to the point where they would think, because I think a lot of his supporters, if they're being honest, Trump does make their skin crawl. I don't believe that, you know, everyone who voted for Trump in 2016 is delusional and thinks he's a great guy. But what's the right balance to strike where they will have seen sufficient numbers of images to think, okay, I just can't even participate in this. But I think that is really important when we think about what's the right way for the so-called never Trump groups to operate, because I think there's a real risk of betraying some of the kinds of conservative principles that we need to show a commitment to these audiences of voters, to say, look, we're on the same team, right? Because it's, you're not going to get people to basically undo, you know, generations of human evolution of wanting to be part of a team, right? So it's important, I think, to continue to signal that we do have a shared belief set, but that right now our shared belief set that we should not have a sociopathic narcissist in the White House who is doing lots of damage to our country and our position abroad supersedes those other things. And that's why we're going to cross over and help the blue team this go round.
Well, of course, but the most difficult thing is that because it is so tribal that this is a campaign that's going to try to convince America again. This is Flight 93. I think you probably saw Newt Gingrich's tweet that, you know, it's not a referendum between Trump and a perfect alternative. It's between President Trump and basically the end of America as we know it. Right. I mean, you know, the radical socialist. And this is a moment where I hope the Democrats realize how lucky they are that it's Joe Biden rather than, say, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren on the ticket, because then I think they would be seeing much different poll numbers. It would make it a much easier job for Trump to do that. But you going back to your story out of Iowa, though, because that implies the story, as you told, implies that even if you assure people that you share the same values and are on the same team in terms of issues and principles, it doesn't matter if ultimately the question is Trump in or Trump out. Right? I mean, so you can go through, we are all of these things, but if the choice comes, throw Trump out of the White House or not throw Trump out of the White House, won't these people still be, I'm on Team Red?
Sure. I think that's a good point. Of course, in the case of the cattlemen in Iowa, we were talking about highly engaged political players in the state. And so most Americans don't live in the world of endorsements, right? But no one wants to feel alone. And so I guess my point is, knowing that you're right, it may be an impenetrable wall for a lot of Americans. But for most of these, I think most Americans that were thinking about being on the cusp of floating one way or another, I think giving them a place, an affiliation that they can feel they're a part of, is super important, because people don't want to feel like they're going it alone.
Right. No, I agree. That's why I think these ads from the Republican voters against Trump have been so effective, because they say, look, you know, we are like you and we're making this decision. So you don't have to abandon all of your principles and all of your beliefs. You know, we know how hard it is going to be anyway to do all of this stuff. You know, there's another factor. Now, as you know, I'm thinking through what's been going on here, I agree with your, you know, analysis of who's going to decide the election. There's an interesting phenomenon listening to Trump and Trump world, which is the underlying contempt for their base. They really think their base is stupid. They think their base is stupid. You know, that whole stunt going across to the church and then holding up the Bible. Who was that aimed at? Who is that aimed at impressing or persuading? You know, except that Trump thinks that all I have to do is do this. And in his mind, there are people who will just be suckered in by that. So I wonder how this plays out, that if Trump is going to play to a dumbed down electorate, that really he does write off the portion of the electorate that is engaged, paying attention, and that may, you know, not be as stupid and crude as he imagines there.
Yeah, I think that's right. And let me just say about the Lafayette Square debacle that, I mean, couldn't have been more of a coming home call to those of us who grew up in the Episcopal Church. It was like so much pride in being an Episcopalian. And I've loved the coverage of a deacon, I think, saying, you know, if Trump knew anything about the Episcopal Church, he would know that we care a lot more about the Book of Common Prayer than the Bible, which I think is really, really funny. But I think that is an important point. I'm sort of joking about that, but it's important because he did go and choose to do this insane stunt in front of a church that is known to be quite liberal and that, of course, was going to have this reaction and is very offensive. And so I know there are a lot of kind of somewhat credible theories going around about, you know, this is some sort of subliminal call to, you know, of the very, very fringy Christian right. I don't know enough about that to say whether it is or not. But I think that he's just betting on this idea that the imagery of that is somehow going to put him over the edge with a certain sector. And I don't really understand that. And one thing that I think is important to understand, or at least, and I'd be interested in what you think about this, about Trump, is that, I mean, a lot of this is dumb luck, right? I mean, there are not like tons of brilliant political strategists in the room with him, but the idea that you go across the street tear gassing protesters and that you then have, you know, your daughter who had a very public conversion to Orthodox Judaism, pull a Bible out of her bag and then you hold it up upside down. That is quite a bet on what kinds of imagery people care about. But you're right. It basically betrays the fact that he thinks Americans are morons.
He does. And so I think that that's one of the things. It's going to be interesting to watch how this campaign plays on. I mean, he is very clearly playing to sort of the lowest common denominator of his own base. Okay, I gotta like roll this past you, though, because I think you and I both have sort of we're straddled and we can sort of see both worlds. I'm watching a lot of the criticism of the Tulsa rally, which is already turning into kind of a foobar. He was originally scheduled to be on Juneteenth Day. People pointed out that was awkward. He moved the date. He's moved into a venue that has been closed because of the COVID-19 epidemic. The local newspaper in Tulsa is recommending that he not come. But there's all this concern about how there won't be enough social distancing at this. And then, of course, all people on the right need to do is show a picture of one of the Black Lives Rally matters. And they're saying, why are you upset about this, but not about this? And, you know, we could parse this. But I have to say that I think people are underestimating the saliency of that argument, that for a lot of people on the right, not just in Trump world, people go, OK, the same people that will attack conservatives for getting together in a big group for killing grandma are completely OK with these other events in which there's no social distancing. I mean, there's a real contradiction there, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it is problematic. I think you can make the case that people coming out to protest systemic racism and police brutality is more important than
yes,
going to the garden store or getting a haircut, and that we can do a cost-benefit analysis. But that does break down when you come back to the fact that a person at a Black Lives Matter rally could very well go become a grandma herself if she then goes and sees her grandma after, you know, being shoulder to shoulder with sweaty people in places that are COVID hotspots. So it is very problematic. And that is an example of the kind of liberal hypocrisy that we see in many, many iterations over and over again, that is really kind of what I was getting at before, that the left does themselves in all the time, and they give Republicans and the right the moral high ground when they don't deserve it. And that is a real problem that they have to get better at.
Well, either the moral high ground or at least the get out of jail card, which is that I don't have to feel guilty for my bad behavior, because what about your bad behavior over here? And again, we're going to get deluged with people saying, well, this is more important and all of this stuff. But I'm just saying how it plays out in real time, because here we are and we're getting these reports that, you know, the coronavirus doesn't care about the fact that we've lost interest in it, that the numbers are rising in certain states. It may not be a complete second wave, but we're in a strange position where the country has basically decided, yeah, we're done with that. We're bored. We're moving on. And the virus isn't having it. So, you know, there's no chance at this point that this country is going to reclose. There's almost a stigma against people who are wearing masks in some communities. And I'm really wondering where we're going to play, how this is going to play out. I mean, it's very clear that our attention span cannot extend past 3 months. And so, if we're back to 1,000 Americans a day dying, we are still going to act like, yeah, but we got to go back. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, and like I was out yesterday, I drove through a local community nearby. My wife and I were really doing social distancing. I drove by, place was packed. People were in the streets. Every single table at every single restaurant was absolutely packed. I think out of several thousand people that I saw, one was wearing a mask. That's it.
I've been hearing reports from things going on in Arizona where, the state is in a very, very bad way because of COVID-19. And likewise, everything is firing on all cylinders and people are not wearing masks. And that's a problem. I think that I'll probably get in trouble for saying this. I think that how this plays with the general public will really be dependent on when another large, undeniable spike comes. I thought that it was really kind of interesting that in the spring, when you had these kind of activists out basically claiming, oh my God, we must reopen, we must reopen, we must reopen, the majority of Americans polled said that they were more worried about reopening too soon. So if you have another spike in September, October, when people are voting, hopefully by mail, if you have another wave of coronavirus then in a way that is really undeniable, and I would say actually in a lot of these places, the data from places like New York and other urban hotspots has been really misleading because a lot of states out west in other places really haven't even had a spike to speak of yet, right? So as those communities begin to experience something on the order of what the Acela corridor experienced a couple of months back, I think that could be pretty impactful for people in the fall. And what it comes down to also is that most Americans are neither people who were out at the Michigan State House, armed and protesting about getting a pedicure, nor are they people shoulder to shoulder in Lafayette Square protesting Black Lives Matter. So I think at the end of the day, it really comes down to those folks who are at home and whose hearts are in the right place. How will they come to terms with this as they square those realities with whom they check the box for on their ballot?
Okay, so while we're talking, there's some breaking news that I think is going to be fascinating to watch as it plays out, because you know that when we use the term Butt Gorsuch, what that means is it was like when you would bring up, well, Trump did this, he wants to sell Greenland, he have kids in cages, he's doing all of this stuff, he pays off porn stars. The response you would get from Trump world was, and actually people, who would concede everything you're saying, but would say, but Gorsuch, because the Supreme Court trumps absolutely everything. And you know how powerful that is transactionally. They're willing to swallow almost everything in order to get conservative Supreme Court justices. So here we are on Monday morning. The Supreme Court has just ruled that gay and lesbian people can sue for workplace bias under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So this was a 6-3 ruling by the court, basically reading in gay and LGBTQ rights into the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The majority opinion was written by, are you ready for this, Lucy?
Mm-hmm.
Gorsuch.
Wow, that's really something.
So it's going to be interesting because, I mean, this was an interesting legal question. I mean, there were people who would say that, look, the 1964 Act, says what it says. And if you want to add protections for gay, lesbian, transgender individuals into that, that would require legislation. So that would have been the traditional, quote unquote, conservative position. But this court, dominated by conservatives, has now rejected that. So 6-3. This is interesting. Tim Alberta is tweeting out about this. Further evidence that the cultural currents are flowing in one direction and Republicans swim upstream at their own political peril. But I'm going to be very interested to see how the quote unquote base reacts to Gorsuch's role in this this decision, which is really right at the heart of a lot of the culture wars, isn't it?
Well, you don't have to go too far back to see how easy it was for conservatives to throw Roberts under the bus over the SCOTUS decision on Obamacare. So it could be that Brett Gorsuch becomes a rallying call of a different group than it has been before.
But Kavanaugh.
Yeah. And I mean, the truth is that the left is almost as ridiculous on judges as the right. I mean, every time it's not realistic and not true that every time we go to the polls, you know, every right that liberals enjoy is in peril because of a would-be judge, right? And by and large, our jurists show themselves to be, I think, fairly open to taking these things under consideration. And I guess this is another example of that. So that'll be interesting to see how it plays out. My, you know, going back to my kind of Goldwater girl libertarian heritage, I hear a decision like that, and my instant reaction is to be put off by it. But I have, as we think about things like reconsidering how we got here, I'm in that class of people who perhaps need to reconsider my view on things like the Civil Rights Act and others. And I guess that's why you would say I am a hardcore conservative in some way, but that's surprising and certainly could actually create a path for Trump and others to say, look, it's not even enough that we have these conservative justices. We have to get more because Gorsuch has betrayed us here. And if Trump is good at anything, it's, coming out unscathed after throwing under the bus people that he was formerly, you know, bosom buddies with.
Yeah. And so the court also just denied hearing Trump's appeal in U.S. versus California, which was challenging California's sanctuary laws. So not necessarily a good day. But you're right. He'll be able to pivot on that and say, this is why you need to reelect me because we need even more conservative judges. But that's 6-3. I have to tell you, I'd been watching that particular case, and that was not something that I certainly expected. And I'm guessing was kind of a surprise. So Lucy Caldwell, thank you so much for coming on the Bulwark Podcast today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. It was really fun.
And thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.